Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer of the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the State Department began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Six Critical Foreign Policy Questions That Won't Be Raised in the Presidential Debates. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And along with climate change, global warming, gun control, and the failed war on drugs, you've added to the list of things that won't be discussed in the presidential debates, in this case, foreign policy. Why is it that the leader of the free world is so insulated against a real political discussion with the American people?
I think it's more of a case that there's so little difference between the two candidates on these very important critical issues that they just feel there's no need to discuss it. The questions that I raised about America's place in the world, whether the global war on terror, what about the effects of the global war on terror on our constitutional rights here in America, unfortunately, there is so little daylight between Obama and Romney on these issues that I think they feel there's no need to even discuss them. You're going to get the same meal regardless of which candidate you vote for, so why bother even to bring it up?
Well, there appears to be some difference on the level of jingoism and pandering, where I think Romney takes the cake. You have number five of your 6 points is, since no one outside our borders buys American exceptionalism anymore, what's next? What is America's point these days? Now, there's no question that they all do the patriotic flourish and the knee-jerk, we're the greatest nation on earth and all this stuff. But isn't there a little bit of a degree of difference here that Obama is actually dealing with reality and Romney has the advantage of dealing with fantasy?
I'm clearly not a supporter of either candidate, and so I speak from as neutral a position as you can be, as angry as I am. I'm afraid that in many ways the Obama administration has simply found nicer ways to say most of the same things that were done during the Bush administration. If you take a look at the state of the world in 2008, 160 people in Guantanamo, America maintaining a policy of indefinite detention, well, that hasn't changed. The drone wars have only picked up in intensity since Obama took office. We're now no longer filling Guantanamo with America's prisoners, we're simply executing them by remote control. The war in Iraq did indeed wind down, but in fact the plan was to end the war on the schedule that Obama did even under the Bush administration. We're still at war in Afghanistan and arguably still terrorizing the same places in the Middle East, Yemen, Somalia, soon northern Mali, that we were in the past, with the added attraction of a pseudo-invasion of Libya, something in Syria, whatever label you want to put it, and then the concerns about Iran to come. I'm very afraid that the daylight between the two candidates in reality on these foreign policy issues is so slight that the rhetoric really is all there is to sort of argue over.
Well, I think your point is well taken, and frankly, Obama gets most of his heat from the political left of the Democratic Party, not from the right. And it does seem to be that this is a right-wing debate, and the only other person that was affecting the debate, of course, was Ron Paul, who is pretty much a libertarian. He's gone from the debate. I mean, is that the problem? Is that there's no representation here for either the Ron Paul position or the American left. And I think if you put those two constituencies together, you'd have a considerable number of people in this country, wouldn't you?
I absolutely agree with you. There was a joke made that I'd like to vote for the candidate that Romney is accusing Obama of being. Ron Paul, again, I did not support him personally, but he represented at least some independent thinking that is sorely lacking. Obama, with not really much of a threat on the left, has skewed so far to the right in looking for support. He understands that the people on the left are either going to stay home or vote for him sort of reluctantly, and I'm afraid that's caused him both in rhetoric to a certain extent, but certainly in policy, to skew far, far, far to the right. We've just learned this week, for example, that 150 soldiers are now in Jordan. These guys are planners, which means that they're there to make way for the next wave that may follow them in. They're there to help secure the Jordanian border. They're there to look after the chemical weapons. And so we're setting the stage for a military intervention in Syria if what you call is going on there is not already being run kind of behind the scenes by some form of the American government. I'm very afraid that we continue to repeat the very same mistakes, invading countries, toppling governments, regime change, all those things. It was Denis Kucinich who said yesterday at the House hearing on the Benghazi attacks that if America wants people to stop attacking our embassies, we may want to stop trying to overthrow their governments.
Well, and he is on his way out, right?
He's on his way out. He lost his re-election bid and is about to become unemployed in about 3 weeks.
Well, he actually got redistricted out by the Governor Kasich of Ohio.
But he'll be on the street nonetheless.
Indeed. Again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer of the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And, of course, following your book, they tried to strip you of your pensions and clearances, et cetera, but you've fought back and have been able to retire. But essentially, the lesson from your book is, in a way, I guess, given that the Israeli military historian Martin Van Buren described the Iraq War as the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his legions into Germany in 9 AD. In a way, it reads like you were a Roman proconsul in some far-off colony. And back in Rome, they were on a different planet. Isn't the real struggle here, and I guess it's implicit in your story, Peter Van Buren, the struggle between the Republic and the Empire?
In a way, I think you've characterized it quite nicely. The American Empire has always been a very reluctant one, in the sense that we've been very forward-leaning in sort of creating the outlines of the empire, and then very reluctant to police it and to allow it to prosper and do some of the things that the Romans were able to do that count as their good deeds, if you will. My time in Iraq was straight out of Caligula. And in fact, we behaved worse than the ancient Romans there, wasting money and making promises to the Iraqi people.
So the quote from Caligula, I guess, is that you don't care if they love us as long as they fear us.
You know, and they did. I don't think they even feared us as much as they just kind of stood back and watched us dig the hole a little deeper, knowing that we would eventually eat ourselves, and they had nothing more to do than sort of wait for that to happen. The outcomes from the Iraq War are not yet tallied. There's a brilliant piece today by Emma Skye on foreign policy where she lists up some of the unintended consequences, the most significant of which, of course, is a resurgent, empowered Iran. If we had to pick a winner from that terrible, sad war in Iraq, the answer is probably Iran. The United States is going to be dealing with the after effects of that Iranian resurgent for a very, very long time, whether the Israeli strike or some other action takes place, or whether we descend into a Cold War situation with Iran in the Middle East. That unintended consequence will continue to bite us in the behind for some time. The resurgence of Sunni jihadi groups, that was given a wonderful kick in the backside from the Iraq War, is something, again, that we are still dealing with. The groups that have taken prominent stand in Libya, all have their genesis in the Sunni jihadi attacks against us in Iraq. They weren't there in Libya when Gaddafi was in power, but through our bumbling attempts at regime change, we've managed to empower them there. And I suspect before everything is done, there'll be something similar taking place in Syria, if not from the other side, the Hezbollah rising. The United States continues, however, to stumble into these situations. It almost reminds me of the old joke that one definition of mental illness is doing the same thing over and over but expecting different results.
Well, the blowback that you're talking about, of course, was an earlier chapter of it from our involvement in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Back in the Carter-Reagan years. But my understanding, again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran of the State Department, who has an article at the Huffington Post, 6 critical foreign policy questions that won't be raised in the presidential debates. Number 3 of your questions is, what do we want from the Middle East? And your answer, of course, is oil. Now, my understanding is that you, and you're correct in saying that the only winner of the Iraq war was Iran, that the neocons in their incredible stupidity and George Bush and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice Don Rumsfeld, all of whom have seemed to have escaped culpability, really did conduct one of the worst strategic blunders in American history. If not world history, but my understanding of what's going on in this surrogate war between the Sunni kings and the newly empowered Iran is that the Sunni kings have come to the realization that because of American stupidity, now the Iranians, because of their influence over Iraq, essentially, if you combine Iran and Iraq's oil, they have the ability to outstrip the Saudi capacity. And that what the Saudis are afraid of is that the Americans are going to wake up one day and say, well, maybe we should make a deal with this, with the Shia instead. And try and bury the hatchet there and leave the Saudis out in the cold. So they're doing everything they can to stir the pot and to get us involved in Syria, for example. What do you think of that scenario?
I think there's a lot to be said for that. The United States has stumbled around the Middle East completely ignorant of the issues of Sunni hegemony and Shia, the relationship between the Sunnis and the Shias. We've just sort of ignored that because it seemed kind of complicated. You know, take a look at the Middle East right now, and what you have is a very powerful Iran resurgent with a powerful military. The United States was conveniently pleasant enough to eliminate its enemies on both its eastern and western borders. And then a growing power in Turkey with a willingness to use its military to lash out at the Kurds, to lash out at the Iraqis, to lash out at the Syrians. And suddenly, you're taking a look at a Mideast that starts to resemble the pre-World War II days, before the United States and Great Britain drew the artificial lines that created Iraq, that created Transjordan, and things like that. And if you're a Sunni, if you're sitting in Saudi Arabia, you're going to start to get real worried about that, because your security becomes then very dependent on the United States and the United States' willingness to continue to engage in direct warfare, direct conflict in the Middle East on your behalf. I think it's a bigger jump to say that the U.S. would simply abandon its geopolitical situation there and go for the oil and just do these things strictly on an economic basis. Gwyn Dyer, a military historian from Canada, has written that everyone understands you can't eat oil, and everyone understands that you have to pay for oil. And if the Western powers would simply come to understand that, and the Middle Eastern powers would understand that, we would simply buy the oil from whoever wanted to sell it to us, and they would sell it to us, and there would be some form of stasis in the Middle East. I'd like to hope that someday we may be rational enough to think that way, but I suspect it won't be in our lifetimes. The United States has somehow figured out that Saudi Arabia is our pal, and there's a long, sordid history. You remarked back on it yourself, going back into the 1980s, where the Saudis were acting as our proxy in setting up the jihadi militias in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And so between all the dirt that would come out if the United States did break faith with the Saudis, as well as the convenience of getting the oil from them, they're still the largest OPEC producer by a large margin. I suspect you won't see a large-scale rearrangement of things in the Middle East. What that means, however, is that you'll see continued strife and struggle as America fails to actually act on its own strong national interests, but also fails to act prudently and simply understand we're going to pay for the oil, and it keeps finding its way into these mid-level ways of trying to thread the needle, which tend not to work out.
Well, Peter Van Buren, given that your disdain for both candidates, which I think a lot of people share, there is, however, one fundamental difference, and that is that the oil and gas companies are exclusively giving money to Romney. I mean, they're pouring a lot of money in. In fact, in 2010, it was the American Petroleum Institute that made the largest donations to get the Republicans to take over the House and to increase their numbers in the Senate. So there's no question that the oil companies are siding. The oil companies are siding with Romney, and obviously, and Romney in the first debate went to town on Obama about money he'd given to green energy, citing a figure of $90 billion. The truth of the matter is surely, and by the way, the United States Navy has been trying to diversify its energy sources because obviously, as a military planner, you would figure, well, what happens if we lose gasoline? So they've actually run a fleet on biodiesel and other alternatives. Now the Republicans in Congress are trying to cut the money off and stop the Navy from doing that. So there seems to me to be a difference there, because if we got off oil, we wouldn't be having this discussion about Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think you're bringing up a kind of a crossover point between foreign policy and domestic policy. And while I would argue that there's not as much difference between the candidates as many of us would like on foreign policy, I think domestically there is enough difference between the two of them that it makes it fairly easy to distinguish. I mean, Romney's, and I'm not much of an expert on domestic policy, but I think it's fair to say that Romney's domestic policies will more favor big business, will more favor the petroleum and the energy companies than what Obama has planned, and that does account for what you're talking about. But there is kind of a crossover here in terms of foreign policy, and there the idea is the oil for the conceivable future is going to come from the Middle East, and unless and until the United States makes some serious domestic decisions about energy independence, and by that I mean solar power, other forms of so-called green power, not simply trying to squeeze every drop of oil out of the last piece of shale. That's a short-term solution, even if it wouldn't destroy the environment. You're going to have to face these foreign policy challenges unless and until you make those tough domestic decisions. In that sense, I think voters do have more of a choice coming up in November between the two candidates, and hopefully they'll consider that carefully.
Well, just in closing, Peter Van Buren, what is your expectation? Even you've put them on notice, and I'm sure they're following your every word here. You put them on notice, and they're not going to talk about the serious stuff. What do you expect to come out of this second presidential debate?
I'm hoping that there is at least a glimmer of some discussion of these very important issues. I'm afraid I've been disappointed in the past on these types of things, and I'm not much of an optimist, but I would hope that instead of simply slinging mud at each other over what happened in Benghazi, that instead there's some discussion about the value or lack thereof of American regime change and intercession, rather than simply pointing fingers at whether pulling out of Iraq at the time that we did was the right or wrong decision. I would hope there would be at least a glimmer of discussion about the value of these kind of interventions by the United States and what happens when we fail to account for the secondary and tertiary effects of it. I'd like to hope for those things, but to be honest, I'm not very optimistic.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer of the State Department who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. And through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with full benefits. He has an article at the Huffington Post, six critical foreign policy questions that won't be raised in the presidential debates.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating, and you